मनोबुद्ध्यहङ्कारचेतानि नाहं न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेन मे चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा
Namaste, good evening, good afternoon, good morning, and everything in between. I'm so happy to be here to see your names coming up for those of you who are here live, to contemplate all of you who are here at the lake, who are with us subtly, and who will be with us tomorrow. I hope you've been enjoying practicing the yamas. And also, I hope you've been enjoying the self-confrontation that they sometimes engender. When I first started practicing yoga, I was a 70s girl. I had led a fairly rackety life. And the yamas and niyamas were just completely off my radar. So when I first began doing these practices, or at least reading about them, contemplating them, listening to my guru talk about them, I was plunged into a self-confrontation that was really quite radical and not always pleasant. And one of the things that I think we all notice as the years go on and our practice deepens is how much these practices have actually become natural and somewhat easeful. And then that's when we can start to look at the subtle core of them, especially the hidden aspects of the non-yamas, you know, our hidden violence, our, you know, kind of basic consumerism, all these qualities that are kind of a part of modern culture, and that the yoga texts really ask us to renounce. So we didn't speak about aparigraha, non-grasping, last week, but I know that I've been working with it, and several of you have mentioned that you're working with it. And I was very interested in somebody's post, one person's post, about how she finds it juicy to grasp for things. And I realized how deeply this feeling is embedded in us, this sense that, you know, we get motivated by wanting something. And how many of the things we buy or hold on to are not just unnecessary. They're not just things we buy or hold on to out of nervousness or insecurity or the feeling of lack, but of course are also literally cluttering up not just our lives but our minds. And with that awareness, I spent last weekend literally decluttering, throwing out papers and files, and noticing, as I know many of you did, how much freedom there is every time you let go of something you've been saving. And, you know, this is not just a yogic idea. The modern-day prophet of Aparigraha, Marie Kondo, the decluttering guru, now has her own TV show. And her prescription, which I think many of you have followed and which I love, is that you just get rid of anything that doesn't give you joy. It's quite a contemplation. And I think that the thing about her approach that's so interesting is that she realized that physical decluttering, and she approaches it this way, is a kind of ritual that leads to inner freedom in a very particular way. So it led me to consider how in the pursuit of the yamas and niyamas, physical rituals are actually very important. You know, they're not enough. You know, they're the external. But because they engage the body in active ways, they also actualize your intentions very palpably. And of course, the body, mind, and spirit subtly influence each other. So when we put our body in a particular position or carry out a particular physical action, it actually really affects the mind. You know, for instance, there's this whole ritual aspect of nonviolence that's practiced in some parts of the world, especially among Buddhists. where you buy birds or fish at live markets and you set them free. And, of course, we do this in our own way in this country, in the Western countries, especially in the United States. When we rescue a dog or a cat, you know, when we give a home to an abandoned animal. And I also want to point out another ritual that is quite powerful. It's a truth ritual, which I learned in the first spiritual group I was part of. Some of you have done this with me. We had this practice where you'd sit with a partner, gaze into their left eye until you established a felt sense of essence contact, and then you would share truths that you might not have been willing to talk about under normal circumstances, insights about each other, thoughts or actions that were creating issues, especially in relationships. And you can also do this truth ritual as a way of confessing your own beauty or your own greatness, which is a partner practice in itself. And I'm going to ask you to do it this week with, you know, as a writing practice. You get in touch with those qualities above all others that connect you to the highest truth, and then you confess them without holding back, recognizing that speaking the truth is not always about sharing things you're embarrassed about, but it's also about sharing things that you don't normally talk about because it sounds like bragging. But it's not actually bragging. It's a kind of truth-telling to start to recognize the higher qualities in yourself. So one of the things that happens as we practice the certain yamas and certain niyamas is that we realize that every one of them has kind of tendrils and strings which affects everything else in our life. As Gandhi wrote in his book, My Experiments with Truth, when he started, you know, when he made a vow to speak the truth all the time, which he did when he was quite young, the first thing he found out was that if he was not allowing himself to lie, then he had to stop doing things that he was tempted to lie about. And that is a really interesting practice. Please forgive me. I'm going to create some static on the line, changing my headset. And of course, inner truth is even more important. Inner truth, of course, means not lying to yourself, which is not always easy. But it also means what we could call truth in meditation. This is something nobody but you can really know, because the thing about meditation is that there's nobody monitoring you. There's nobody calling you out. But what it means to be true in meditation is to remain conscious, to remain fully attentive. It means that you have to start calling yourself out, actually not being willing to give over your meditation to thoughts and ruminations. I'm just going to mute myself for a second and get rid of the dryness in my throat. So basically, truth in meditation means you don't let yourself sit in meditation and think all the time. And again, this is not really an easy thing to do. So inner truth is a very refined kind of vigilance, which is, of course, part of what we get from practicing the yamas and niyamas. Because actually, the whole practice of the eight-limbed yoga rests on your willingness to keep track of where the mind is going. So let's find ourselves at the lake. Find your posture. And let's just take this moment to really find the posture, to ground ourselves through the sit bones, to inhale downward and feeling yourself supported by the seat, to exhale upward. Let the spinal column rise up through the crown. Take a couple of deep breaths. Let your head rise to the ceiling, as though it's being pulled by an invisible cord from the fontanelle. Let your chin slightly tuck. Remember, when you're sitting straight in this posture, it's very easy to kind of let your head fall back, to let your chin raise, and this creates too much of a curve in the back of the neck. We'll talk about this next week in more detail when we actually explore asana. And you can bring your hands into Anjali Mudra or just place one hand over your heart, the right hand over your heart, the left hand on top of it. And we're going to chant Om three times, and then we'll chant our invocations. Om. Shivaya Gurave Satchit Ananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sadike Sharanye Triambake Gauri Narayani Namostute. Vande Gurunam Charanaravinde Sandarshita Swatma Sukhavabodhe Nishreyase Jangalikayamane Samsarahala Halamohashantye Abahu Purushakaram Shankachakra Siddharinam Sahasra-shira-samshtvetam Paranamami Patanjalim Paranamami Patanjalim Paranamami Patanjalim. And as you sit in your posture now, find yourself on the shores of the Great Lake, the Great Deep Blue Bottomless Lake of Consciousness. And let's be aware of all of us present here, those of us who are live, those of us who will be joining tomorrow or next week, and also anyone that you would like to be present at the lake. And as you let yourself settle into the energy of this very still place, this very open place, a space where awareness sharpens, where truths can be heard at the deepest level, where the love that's at the heart of this cosmos comes off the lake like mist and draws us all together into its folds. And as you sit, become aware of the subtle light within your own heart and the light that's present in the heart of all the beings who are sitting here with us. And become aware of the presence of the lineage beings who've gathered around to bless us and to help us come deeper into the understanding of what is true and what matters. The fruit, the siddhi, the superpower that we get from swadhyaya, from study, from mantra practice, is the darshan of the presence of deities and great beings who begin to become alive for us and be palpably experienceable through our practice, through our study, through our mantra. And so be aware that there's so many beings gathered around us, beings of my lineages, beings of your lineages, ascended masters, sages, deities, and their presence is entirely focused on opening your heart, opening your mind, giving us the power of insight to see deeply into what is true. Find in your hand the candle, maybe the size of a tea light or a deepa, a wick dipped in clarified butter and held in a clay pot. And as you hold the light in your hands, feel that a flame comes out of your index finger and ignites the wick on the candle. And holding it in your hand, ask that our practice be of benefit to all beings. Ask that all beings be free of suffering. Ask that all beings know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. Ask that all beings be free of grasping, hatred, and dullness. Ask that we know the equality of all that lives. And now you're invited to consider your own personal intention, either for this evening or a general intention that you want to bring to the lake. And as you place your intentions in the candle and place the candle on the lake, with awareness that we're in the presence of the deepest, subtlest form of wisdom, and let yourself be present with the flow of the breath. And we're going to do a practice that's a little bit specific and technical, and which asks us to be attentive. So bring your attention to the space at the opening of the nostrils, just inside the nostrils. We could call the threshold of the nostrils, where the breath, the inhalation, touches. And see if you can sense the feeling of the breath as it flows in through the edges of the nostrils and then through the roof of the nostrils under the bridge of the nose. Sense the breath flowing upward, up through the nasal passages, touching the inside of the corners of your eyes, just right at the inner edge of your face. And then flowing upward to the space between the eyebrows, to the space of the forehead, and just rising. And then allow the exhalation to come smoothly without a space as much as possible, flowing down from above the head through the space behind the forehead, the space behind the eyebrows, corners of the eyes, the upper roof of your nostrils, and out the edge of the nostrils. See if you can find this flow, this path, as a sensual experience of Prana Shakti herself flowing through the breath. Follow the inhalation into the edges of the nostrils, up through the inside top of the nose, through the space at the inner corners of the eyes, the space just behind the eyebrows, in the center between the eyebrows, the inside space of the forehead, and just let it rise as far as it wants to and then begin to flow back down. Allow the breath to follow this path. And let your focus gently attend to the sensual experience of the breath as it touches these spaces in the head, just inside the body. No thought, no mantra, just the touch of the breath. Ah, okay. I hear you. So what happened was we somehow got muted. And I'm going to go back to where we started and talk about purity. So forgive me if I'm repeating myself. Shalcha purity has historically been associated with racism and sexism, not to mention the various kinds of religious purity that were so much a part of traditional religions, especially in India and also in other, you know, in other Orthodox systems. There's a very telling story about Dr. Martin Luther King. When he visited India in the 60s, he was invited to address a meeting of members of the untouchable castes. You know, an untouchability was outlawed in India at the time of independence, but it's still practiced, or at least the caste system is still a factor in India. He was introduced at this meeting as an untouchable from America. So he later shared that he'd been quite shocked by the introduction because he was a Nobel Prize winner, you know, an internationally famous leader and minister, and also because he came from a very distinguished family. But as he contemplated the event, he realized that it was actually a correct description because racism in the United States is actually the equivalent of the caste system in India, which is also based to a large extent on skin color. So, we remember so many of the negative connotations of this idea of purity, for instance, in Hitler's Germany and in the white supremacy movement. The blonde, blue-eyed Northern European races are considered more pure than anybody else in Judaism. In Orthodox Judaism, non-Jews or non-Orthodox Jews are considered impure because they're not following the same food rules and cleanliness rules that Orthodox people do. And then, of course, there's the old idea that a woman is unclean during menstruation, which the association of purity with virginity. And in India to this day, menstruating women are not supposed to take part in pujas, at least in some aspects of the community, or in some communities, even to touch or cook other people's food. So let's eliminate those interpretations of Shalcha entirely, including the rationales that have been found for them, and try to look at what genuine purity really is. So now, obviously, it means external cleanliness, which, of course, means keeping your body and your living space clean. And again, I don't have to tell you this, because we know from experience that when you clean your room, you clean your mind. So I first began to understand the yogic aspect of cleaning when I began traveling with my guru, and I had the job of cleaning the altar in his meditation hall. I noticed that when I cleaned the altar, it had an almost miraculously cleansing effect on my mind. You know, and I realized at that point that not that I didn't keep my house and clothes and body clean before, it's just that I had never noticed the connection between scrubbing a floor or washing your clothes, especially washing them by hand, I have to say, and scrubbing your own psyche. So there's an entire practice of inner clarification that you can do, and I know many of you know exactly what I'm talking about when you're feeling confused or out of sorts, which might just include washing your dishes, tidying your desk, taking a shower, or even just washing your hands. And as long as you don't get too OCD about it, it really has a remarkable effect on your mood and also on your state of mind. And of course, bodily cleansing, purity, detox is almost an obsession these days in the self-care and yogic cultures. And I'm sure that most of you have done major detox routines. Maybe you check your food sources for purity. Maybe you've renounced non-natural soaps and cosmetics and cleaning materials. And again, these practices make a big difference in your health and sometimes lead us to become really quite rigorous about keeping toxins out of your food. You know, in traditional India, especially in yogic circles, there are all kinds of prescriptions about what it's okay to eat and what we need to do to assure the purity of our environment. You know, in fact, in hardcore hatha yoga circles and in Ayurveda, there are daily practices of internal cleansing that start with pouring water through your nostrils, which is, you know, something that many of us do for clearing allergies from our sinuses, you know, to very intense practices like swallowing a cloth and pulling out the accumulated phlegm from your stomach. So that insistence on bodily cleanliness can become a whole practice in itself. And, you know, if you were doing hardcore yoga with a traditional hatha yogi, you probably would be doing many of those practices, maybe even every day. So I want to offer us an internal cleansing practice, which kind of has the same effect, but on a more subtle level. So find your posture. And as the breath flows in and out of the body, feel that it's flowing in from a region far above your crown, from the center of the solar system, and that subtle sunlight is flowing through your body from the crown all the way down through your face, through your brain, through your neck, through your shoulders and chest and arms and hands, down through your abdomen, flowing through your body, down through the feet. And as you exhale, feel that any toxins, any toxic thoughts, any old karmas flow upward with the breath and flow back to the sun. And then once again, just imagine these showers of sunlight flowing through your body from the crown all the way to the feet. And this time with the exhalation, feel that any toxins, any mental toxins, any karmic toxins are actually being sent into the earth. And just take a moment or two to feel the showers of subtle sunlight flowing through your body from the crown to the feet, and the karmic residues flowing out through your feet into the earth. Of course, inner purity is the point, is the heart of it all. And one of the most beautiful statements about purity, which is, of course, a very big deal in almost all religious cultures, comes from Søren Kierkegaard, the great Danish philosopher, who was a pretty scrupulous Christian. He wrote once, "Purity of heart is to will one thing. Purity of heart is to will one thing." It's an aphorism that I've been contemplating for years, and I think what he meant is that there's a kind of singleness of intention, a way of clearing your heart so that you're not feeling in contradiction with yourself. By becoming clear about what your overarching aim is, what your overarching goal is. So the question, I would say that one of the deeper questions of practicing inner purity is to ask yourself, how do I stay out of inner conflict? You know, if you've if you've ever been in a relationship you were ambivalent about, or a job that you weren't sure you wanted, you probably get how debilitating it is not to be absolutely sure that your will and your actions are in alignment. And it's partly because a commitment is really the secret of any form of success. But the deeper truth is that when we're internally divided, we activate all of our self-sabotaging and confused samskaras. And confusion is one of the most disturbing aspects of a clouded mind. So I want to ask you a question right now. And just ask, you know, as we did with the previous contemplation, don't try to think too much about it, but just ask yourself, what are I confused about now? What's the main thing that I'm confused about that gets me lost in contradiction or doubt? Are you doubting your purpose? Are you not sure about the right thing to do in a particular situation? Doesn't have to be a big deal, but just notice what it feels like to be confused, what it feels like not to be able to make up your mind about something. And notice how ambivalence, doubt, confusion actually creates agitation in your inner space. And how when we're living in a state of doubt or confusion or ambivalence, the tendrils of it actually start to occupy our consciousness, often when we're not even aware that we're thinking about it. Very often, just making a decision about something will clear boatloads of unclarity in your mind, in your awareness, and is actually one of the most cleansing practices you can do. Now, it's not always easy when you're making a difficult decision about the course of your life, but for many situations, it's just a very good rule of life to just stop second-guessing yourself, to give yourself the discipline of making up your mind and just letting it be. And of course, another is not to add more to the self-criticism, resistance, negative thinking that seems to be a natural part of the average mind. I mean, as we spend time looking at our samskaras, noticing them, substituting mantra or positive thoughts for the negative ones, perhaps noticing how disruptive certain patterns are. And the other thing that comes up, it's a big issue with the practice of cleanliness, and you've probably thought of it even as we're talking here. How much information can we take in about what's going on in the world? Especially now, you know, how do we discern what we need to know in order to be a responsible citizen without taking in so much information that you fall into anger or despair? You know, and how can you be committed to social justice and the inner discomfort that sometimes causes without letting your mind get so disturbed by the injustices that you see that you become seriously anxious and agitated and angry? So purity of mind, which goes with purity of speech, very often involves making decisions about how much input you're going to allow. Not that we always have control, but in many areas we do. And it's very much related to truthfulness and nonviolence. And it often seems to go against the grain of contemporary life. But, you know, one thing that does start to happen as your practice gets stronger is that you become very sensitive about maintaining the purity of your mind and tongue. You know, for instance, you start to notice how destructive gossip can be, and if you're like most of us, what a temptation it can be to engage in especially negative gossip or schadenfreude, you know, or the other aspects of negative thinking about other people. You can start to listen to yourself, how certain things you say or certain things you let other people say around you are actually disturbing, which is why one of the most revealing contemplations you can engage in, and again, I'm going to ask you to do it this week, it's become actually one of my major contemplations, is to look at those moments that you engage in negative gossip or dissecting other people or noticing your own mistakes and other people's mistakes. Belkin was talking about guilt in one of his posts, and someone answered him by, Ellen answered him by pointing out the difference that Brené Brown makes about between guilt and shame. Guilt being realizing you've made a mistake, shame being the idea that you are a mistake, which I think is a very sweet, aphoristic way of talking about it. But these are both qualities that, of course, create disturbance in the mind. And I also want to flag something about the practice of purity that can seem problematic, but it's actually one of the main yogic fruits of the practice. There is a point you reach when you discover that it's hard to be around certain people because their mental state and their words are disturbing. And often there are people that are perfectly nice people, but there's something about the way they approach the world that activates, often it's because they trigger your own negativity, is the truth. And the difficult thing is that they're sometimes close friends and family members. I want to say that becoming conscious of the effect of your company is one of the yogic fruits of practicing cleanliness. And as I say, it's complicated and difficult when the people you have a hard time being around include people you love, people you care about. And there often is a period of practice when you need to stop having certain conversations, which sometimes means not spending time with certain people. And the question that arises is, how do you do this? How do you detox from certain relationships without shaming other people, without rejecting other people, without becoming one of those self-righteous yogis who's, you know, kind of looking around the world and saying, this is untouchable for me? We don't really want to do that because there's a certain violence in rigorously maintaining purity when it involves cutting ourselves off from other people. This is something that we all get to look at and that we all get to go through and that we all get to make our own decisions about. And I think for many of you who've been at this for a while, you'll notice that you go through periods of extreme attention to detoxing and periods when you're more relaxed about it. And that, as with all yogic practice, it's always a question of balance. You go too far in one direction, you come back. You go far too far in the other direction, you come back. And one more thing about this, and this comes from Swami Vivekananda, who was one of the great yogis who first brought Vedanta to the West in the early 20th century. He used to say that the first sign of true spirituality is cheerfulness. So in other words, purity of mind really starts with learning how to establish and come back to cheerful moods, positive moods, not Pollyanna-ish positive thinking, but just reminding yourself, discovering ways to literally cheer yourself up. And this is where, of course, we come to the process of santosha. And also, the fruit of practicing cleanliness, meaning all levels of cleanliness, is, according to Vyasa, the commentator on the Yoga Sutras, is the natural experience of blissfulness, which is, remember, our natural state. So Vyasa says, the yogin practicing cleanliness gets purification of heart, which leads to mental bliss or spontaneous feelings of joy. From mental bliss develops one-pointedness, which leads to subjugation of the senses. And from this, the buddhi develops the power of realizing the self. So if you consider how much of the practice of the yamas and niyamas is actually about mentally detoxing, cleaning yourself, as it were, letting go of the stuff that is clogging your mind and heart, it brings you back to the recognition that behind all this, there is the fount of joy, the fount of blissfulness, which is our natural state. So let's contact some natural bliss through the breath practice that we were doing earlier. Once again, find your posture and feel that showers of light are flowing in through your crown, bathing your brain, flowing through your head, your neck, flowing down your body, filling your chest and abdomen, turning your arms and hands to light, carrying with them any mental disturbance, any little emotional cooties, even physical disease. Feel the light flowing down through your body, through your lower abdomen, through your genitals, through your hips, your legs, your feet, and into the earth. So with the exhalation, the toxins, the impurities all flow into the earth. With the inhalation, light showers through your body. So this brings us naturally to the practice of santosha, contentment, which, of course, is one of those core yogic practices that once we start doing any form of self-help, even before we may actually not be doing active inner or outer yoga practice, the practice of contentment, like the practice of gratitude and forgiveness, becomes something that we realize we need to cultivate. And it's interesting that even though so many of us are aware of what a powerful effect negativity has on our body-mind, we often don't take the practice of contentment and the fact that we have a choice about it as seriously as we might. Maybe because complaining about the world is such a powerful way of bonding, or maybe because so much of our negativity is just there in our system, so much a part of the way we think and feel that we don't actually notice it. I know this isn't true of everybody, but it certainly was true of me for many years, that the different tendrils of negativity were, I just thought it was normal. I was very struck years ago by reading something that Bertrand Russell said. He said, we have a duty to be happy. We have a duty to be happy. And when you contemplate it, what he's really implying here is that happiness is something we have a choice about. You know, that when sadness or anger or discontent surface, We don't necessarily have to endure it or distract ourselves from it or push it away by pretending we're not unhappy, because the genius of this particular practice is that once we crack the code of santosha, which is essentially the practice of self-acceptance, or in yogic terms, understanding that what we have is enough, is the way Vyasa puts it. And, you know, once you start doing that, you really have choices at pretty much any moment. I have a friend who's going through a really rough patch, and it's been going on for several years. And one of the things she told me recently is that in order to get through it, she wakes up every morning and she talks herself into a state of contentment. And she does it by saying to herself, what I have is enough. There's nothing I lack. What I am is enough. What I do is enough. She says that simple practice of self-acceptance, which actually comes out of the Yoga Sutras, has been tremendously powerful in helping her be present to a hard time without constantly freaking out or being depressed. So the dictionary defines contentment as the state of satisfaction with one's possession, status, or situation. And what it actually brings up for us, you know, as we start to recognize it, is that contentment is an independent state. It doesn't have to depend on something external. Now, most of us know how to practice discontentment. You know, we know that when you worry about the future, when you compare your achievements, looks, and body weight to other people's, when we tell ourselves negative stories about our lives, you know, we actually are practicing the anti-contentment sutras. I mean, literally, we practice anti-contentment sutras all the time. I can't stand this person. What if I fail? So-and-so is so much smarter than me. I've never been good at this. You know, all those, he's so annoying, all those things, you know. The yogic practices for getting to contentment are often simply ways of reversing our anti-contentment practices. And I also, you know, I know I don't have to say this to you, but practicing contentment is not the same as being content with other people's difficulties. In other words, being content with ourselves is not incompatible with working, with pushing ourselves or helping other people. It's just that we do it from a place of recognizing that where we are is okay. And that usually means letting go of the various conditions, conscious or unconscious, that we place around our ability to be content. You know, you might have noticed that as a modern, you know, hardworking person, there's probably some part of you, especially those of us who have type A personalities, that believes that we can't fully relax into contentment unless we've completed a project, put in a respectable amount of hours working, taken a walk. You know, in other words, there's some driver in us that means we can't feel content, we can't feel okay until we've achieved something or built something or found the right partner or have enough money in the bank. So there's a couple of levels of accessing your own contentment, one of which, of course, is simply working with the various tools that help counteract dissatisfaction, talking back to your judgmental inner voices, you know, taking a moment in the middle of a tough day to just stop, feel your feet on the ground, breathe from the diaphragm, you know, get a little exercise, have a bite to eat. Sometimes, you know, what's making us discontent is that we're hungry or we're tired or we need to drink water, taking a walk in the fresh air. The second level is to learn how to hang on to the feeling of contentment when it arises. So how do we do that? How do we get to lasting contentment, the kind that's there even when the bottom is falling out of your life? And I think what we discover is that it's actually it's a transformative journey. It requires an inner realignment that probably demands that you look squarely into the causes of your own dissatisfaction. In other words, that you actually do some inquiry into discontent, because discontent isn't random. It's not just the result of your temperament and your habits of thinking. It is to a certain extent a karmic pattern, but it contains a message. Dissatisfaction contains a message, a built-in wake-up call, and it's almost always because we're out of touch with some aspect of our authentic self and with the desires that come from our heart's core. And as yogis, I want to say that it probably means when we're really radically discontent that we've kind of gotten out of touch with our deepest longing, which is to love and be loved, you know, to be present, to be able to be here in the moment. And so we rarely achieve a condition of lasting contentment until we're willing to examine our own feelings of dissatisfaction, to trace them to their source, and then find a way to make steady contact with your feeling of internal nourishment. And because we can't always count on other people or our physical health or, you know, being in a situation that feels pleasant, we can't always count on those things to be there. Finding the internal source of contentment is really incredibly important and necessary. Here's how one yogic commentator put it, and I think we spoke about it in an earlier class. Just as to escape from thorns, it is necessary only to wear shoes and not to cover the face of the earth with leather, so happiness can be derived from the practice of contentment and not from thinking I shall be happy when I get everything I wish for. We're just letting that sink in. I know you've all heard this a million times, but somehow we all keep thinking that if this just one thing would change, everything would be okay. So let's experiment for a moment with this yogic affirmation. As you inhale, have the thought, what I have is enough. And notice what happens in your body. As you exhale, think, what I do is enough. As you inhale, think, what I am is enough. And as you exhale, think, what I'm given by this world is enough. What I have is enough, inhaling. What I am is enough. What I do is enough. What I am given by this world is enough. What I have is enough. What I do is enough. What I am is enough. What I'm given by this world is enough. And you may notice as you practice this that it's relaxing. At least I think for most of us there's a kind of letting go of tension that happens with this thought. And it also brings up doubts. You know, what about my dreams and wishes? What about the achievements that I haven't yet made? What about improving my relationship? What about doing something about the environment or the making sure that farm workers get a living wage. And isn't this practice an invitation to goof off or a consolation prize for losers? So, again, practicing being content with what you have is not a synonym for resignation any more than surrender is a synonym for giving up effort. Resignation is about despair. Contentment comes from seeing the intrinsic goodness in what is. It's actually a recognition of the fundamental goodness of yourself. And it's a powerful platform for action because it actually starts to remove the fear and the tension of striving that infects almost every moment of our lives until we've mastered this practice. As we begin to investigate our experience of contentment, we do have to investigate our experience of discontent. And because we know that you don't change your state by resisting it or by pretending it's not there any more than you get rid of unfulfilled desires by telling yourself to give them up. You know they're there, they're in your system. So the first step is always to stop and let yourself be fully where you are in this moment. You know, even if where you are is frustrated, out of sorts, insecure, scared, full of dissatisfaction, thwarted ambition. You know, we're sometimes afraid to do that because we imagine that we'll end up just getting caught in unhappiness. But again, accepting your situation is very different than giving in to self-pity because acceptance lets us relax the inner muscles that keeps us trying to control the uncontrollable. So again, moving towards contentment in this moment, let's say, starts with letting yourself be present with what's happening. And I'm hoping that you're not discontented in this moment. But as you focus on the breath, as you let the breath be the anchor you use to keep yourself steady, again, think of something that brings up your feeling of dissatisfaction. Notice how it feels. And ask yourself, what's behind this feeling of frustration, discontentment, sadness? What's underneath the fear? And just ask yourself the question and breathe into it. What's beneath the dissatisfaction? Don't start to analyze it, though that's something that you might want to do later. Just start to notice what happens when you breathe into one of your customary feelings of dissatisfaction, just letting it be there, letting yourself be content with the dissatisfaction. Letting yourself be okay with it. And again, notice this is an aspect of a practice we were doing earlier. Notice how when you accept dissatisfaction without resisting it, it actually begins to shift. The feeling state of dissatisfaction begins to morph. And this is because the act of acceptance, which is also, of course, an aspect of contentment, just seems to connect us to our own source, to that subtle level of being where stuck energy, stuck relationships, stuck situations start to resolve on that inner level even before we've actually done anything to move them. So this might be a moment when you can breathe in showers of light, let them flow through your body. Let them irradiate the residue of the feelings of dissatisfaction. And let the feelings just flow into the earth. One of the things that I come to again and again when I come across some part of myself or my life that I'm not accepting, the question that always comes up is, all right, am I authentically expressing who I am? Is my life expressing who I authentically am? Or is my dissatisfaction in this moment because I'm acting or living the way my culture and family and peers and even my spiritual principles tell me I'm supposed to be living? Because there is, you know, there's always a temptation, there's always a part of us which wants to fit in, which wants to settle, which does things and says things because we think we should. And if you ask yourself the question, am I being authentically myself? And ask it in the deepest way, because, you know, as one of my teachers once said, when we talk about being ourselves, we're really not talking about being our egoic self. We're talking about being our true self, which has a unique flavor for every one of us. You know, the way you express your true self is not going to be necessarily the same way that I do. But when you're not expressing the flavor of your authentic self, there's going to be a kind of a basic discontent and even shame because you're out of touch with your own unique divinity. I have a friend who's a spiritual teacher, and he told me that one of his big breakthroughs happened when he decided to release his need to be impressive. Now, he said, sometimes one of my students invites me to dinner, and they'll have invited their friends to meet their teacher, and everyone will be looking at me for wisdom, and I won't have a thing to say. And, you know, a few years ago, I would have just forced myself to hold forth, to perform, and then I would have felt bad if I wasn't up to snuff. And I find that I can be there now, just be as dorky as I am at this moment, and feel okay about it. Let it be. And that, I believe, is one of the secrets of contentment. Again, find your posture. We're going to do another very radical practice, this one from the Vijnanabhairava. And this is the practice of imagining that your entire body is filled with bliss. Just have this thought. My entire body is filled with bliss. Sometimes you can do this, just say to yourself, my body is filled with bliss, and it just comes alive. sometimes not necessarily. But one of the siddhis, the superpowers that comes online as we practice contentment, this is according to Vyasa, it's unsurpassed constant happiness, happiness that's present no matter what, the ability to be happy even when your life is going badly. And I think we can all recognize that this is a gift. It's one of the major gifts that we get from yoga. We're moving on to the practices for not only practicing the yamas and niyamas, but for antidoting their opposites. You know, the yamas and niyamas, as you know, we have pretty much figured out, they're designed to counteract the kleshas, the afflictions. And in order to do this, they actually have to be available in the moment. So that means you need a repertoire of contemplations that actively counter the impulses of the kleshas, because as we've been saying, the brain is Velcro for negativity, Teflon for positive thoughts. And that's not a joke. It's a very aphoristic, beautiful way of saying it. But the truth is that this is not just a brain state, because the organization of the brain is the physical analog for our subtle organization. And what that means is that the reason that we're so prone to negative thinking, negative memories, is because of the kleshas. The so-called afflictive samskaras are lodged in the psyche, which is why it's sobering to take a good hard look at your own mind. And as you know, if you've read a lot of spiritual literature, you know that spiritual poetry is full of the lamentations of yogis and seekers and mystics who become increasingly aware of what's going on inside their minds. You know, that wonderful quote from St. Augustine, who was trying to work with his lust, which for an early Christian was considered a very obstructive quality. He would pray, "Oh Lord, make me chaste, but not yet." You know, the question of moving from our afflicted state to a state of being free of affliction is an issue for everybody. So the Sutra 233, says, Vitarka Bhadane Pratipaksha Bhavanam. Pratipaksha Bhavanam. It means to arrest afflicting thoughts, cultivate thoughts opposed to them. And now, I think this is one of the most powerful sutras in the Yoga Sutra. There are two ways to interpret it, and I want to give you the interpretation that Vyasa, the hardcore sage who wrote the most authoritative commentary on this, on these sutras. I want to say about Vyasa, by the way, you know, as many of you know, he's one of the legendary sages in the Indian tradition, and he's credited with a number of great spiritual texts written through the centuries. So obviously Vyasa was not necessarily an actual living person. He's supposed to have written the Mahabharata, the Brahma Sutras, which is one of the great works of Vedanta, commented on the Yoga Sutras. So the probability is that anonymous sages commented using his name, but his commentary is considered the essential authoritative commentary from the tradition of Sankhya. What Vyasa says about working with your kleshas, working with your negative samskaras, is the pratipaksha bhavana that he recommends is to begin to recognize that your negative tendencies are the cause of your pain. And again, this is one of those things, we know this. You know, it's kind of obvious. But many of us, and I don't think any of us escapes this, has a habit of justifying our negative tendencies. no, of course I can't forgive that person. They did something so horrible to me. I never want to speak to them again. Or, you know, I know I don't really need that sweater, but it's so pretty. And I've worked so hard this month. And even though I'm kind of maxed out on my credit cards, what the hell? You know, these are klesha-driven thoughts. And they all create more of the tendencies that have given rise to them in the first place. And once we get serious about this process of internal purification, which is necessary in order for us to be what we truly already are, paradoxically enough, we actually have to learn how to talk ourselves out of it. And I'm going to give you a recent example. A friend of mine was visiting, and she got married about 6 months ago. But before she met her husband, she had a long romantic relationship with a guy who had left her and whom she had never quite gotten over. And she was on the way, this is before the pandemic, and she was traveling. She was on her way to the city of her ex-boyfriend. And, of course, she was thinking about going to see him. And she asked me whether I thought it was a good idea. So she said she was pretty sure that if her husband knew she was seeing her ex, he'd be upset. So she'd probably have to conceal her visit from her husband. And then there was a possibility that she and her ex would have sex, which is always a, you know, major part of their relationship. And then she certainly wouldn't be able to tell her husband about that. So I suggested that she contemplate the pros and cons. What would seeing her ex feel like? Would it make her feel, you know, more pain over their breakup? Would it make her feel less happy with her husband? What would it feel like to conceal this from her husband? Would she be able to pull it off? In other words, I asked her to weigh the potential suffering of seeing her ex against the suffering of not seeing him and make a decision on that basis. And she wrote me afterwards. She decided not to visit her ex. She said that when she got home, she was really glad she hadn't created the potential conflict, and that doing that contemplation had helped her realize one of the points about conscious suffering, that there are certain kinds of tapas, certain kinds of suffering, that are useful because they remove something else. One form of pratipaksha bhavana, and this is Vyasa's favorite, is to think through the possible consequences of a klesha-driven action and the karmic residue it might leave. And this will cause you to be very mindful, sometimes more mindful than you want to be, but it's incredibly transformative. And I want to give you, just to give you a sense of how hardcore classical yogis work with this practice, I'm going to read you what Vyasa says about it. This is the direct words from his commentary. When you experience feelings of hatred, etc., and are tortured by the agonizing fiery passions that lead to wrong course of conduct, such as, I shall kill him who hurts me, I shall speak untruth, I shall take his things, I shall commit adultery with his wife, one should encourage contrary thoughts. The yogin should contemplate, roasted on the pitiless burning coal of the cycle of births, I took refuge in the virtues of yoga by promising security to all living beings. After having abjured such perverse thoughts, I am behaving like a dog in betaking myself to them. As a dog licks his vomit, so it is for me to take up thoughts and lines of actions that I have already discarded as wrong. This type of opposite thinking is to be practiced also in respect of the methods prescribed in other sutras. In other words, this is the stick aspect of yogic inspiration. The yogis give us the carrot of the beautiful results of these practices, and they also give us the stick of recognizing what the terrible consequences might be of not practicing them. One form of pratipaksha bhavana is to scare yourself. by thinking about all the difficulties that you experience as a result of glacier-driven habits. The other form of pratipaksha bhavana, which is one that you can do moment by moment and which is very effective also, and it's more positive, is to substitute an opposing positive thought to the one that's being driven by the kleshas. And you can do it with feelings and energies as well as thoughts. And I know you've all done this. It's a practice in Shaivism. It's one of the practices of the approach to yoga that's called Shakta Upaya, where we work directly with the energies in the mind. And what is interesting when you do this kind of pratipaksha bhavana is to look at the various levels at which you can practice thought substitution. For instance, I'll give you an example. If you're worried about your health, there's a way, we could call it normal thinking, there's a way of countering that fear by saying to yourself, it's going to be all right, or by saying to yourself, I'm going to do this and this and this practice for taking care of my health, and this will help ensure that I don't get worse. Or you could go a little bit deeper. Go to the level of really looking at what may be driving, you know, obsessive fear or worry. And here we're talking about the kind of worry that nags at you, that's there when you've done everything you can do about it. And say to yourself, I can meet this difficulty. I have help and I know how to handle it. In other words, remembering your core strengths and letting go of the feeling of helplessness. Or you could expand your awareness and take a kind of wider view and feel yourself held in the hands of the infinite, actually taking refuge. Or you could have a yogic idea like, whatever happens to my body, my essential self cannot be touched. So everything that disturbs our mind can be and actually needs to be dealt with on all these levels. So in other words, you know, when you're angry at someone, when you dislike somebody, it's very helpful to substitute a more positive thought about them, to remember the goodness that he or she has done, or to remember that they may have had a difficult childhood. Or you could consider what the feelings of dislike do to your own psyche, or look at how you might be projecting. Or you could hold a higher thought like, this person is fully part of the divine mind. This person is made of consciousness. And again, in the practice of working with your own negativities, working with your own mental and emotional difficulties, it's always really good to start by acknowledging the negativity itself. You know, I mean, let's say you're feeling out of sorts. You could ask yourself, what's this about? What's it related to? Is it something I'm worried about? Is there some way I can take care of it physically? Do I need to eat something? Should I take a shower? You know, maybe I'm dehydrated. There's an awful lot that you can take care of by having a glass of water. Or is it something that is, you know, actually lodged in my psyche? So you start to state the feeling or the thought out loud. You say, okay, I'm sad about my mother's illness. I'm worried about whether I can handle all the work I have to do right now. You know, I'm mad at my husband. So say it out loud. And this is the start of working with a klesha-driven thought. You acknowledge it. You say it out loud, similar to what we were talking about earlier about looking into your discontent. And the second part is to come up with an alternative thought. So this can initially be one that speaks directly to the first one. Perhaps it's fine to be sad. Or if I take one step at a time, I'll be able to get all this done. Or, you know, I know I'm angry at him now, but remember what a great partner he is. thoughts like this are helpful on a purely human level, and we need to address them. But then there are also the thoughts that address the problem at the deeper level, at the spiritual level. Thoughts like, I offer all this just as it is into the hands of the divine. What I have now is enough. Everything is being taken care of. Or taking it to an even more global level, all this is an aspect of myself, including this person I now don't like. Everything that exists is Shakti. Is there any love present? Can I feel it? So, Pratipaksha Bhavana, whether it's reminding ourselves of the consequences of letting negative thoughts and behaviors stay in our minds, or actively working to transform the way we're thinking, is core yoga of daily life. And the more we become present to examining our motives, learning the difference between compassion and enabling, between accepting ourselves and justifying our inner laziness, between righteous justice and punitive actions and thoughts based on anger, we learn our own patterning. We get to see not only the obviously klesha-driven behaviors, but the subtle hidden ones, the resistance to growth, the negativities we hang on to, and the deepest form of clinging. And as we practice the yamas and niyamas together, and together with our meditation practice, we realize that we're accessing the grace that's embedded in the great mantras, and especially the power of our connection to the highest truth. And as we have more and more sense of connection to the different forms and phases and inner states of the great self, it becomes natural to take refuge in grace, or as one of the commentators on this sutra says, to place our mind in the tranquil mind of the divine. And so we come, as always, as we've been doing over and over again, to surrender to the gifts and transformative releases that come when we surrender our small self, our confusion, our apparent imperfections, into the beauty that is the higher self. So, find your posture. Allow your awareness to come to the breath. Feel the showers of light flowing through your crown and bathing your body. And feel that your body actually is really being filled with light. That this light, which we're accessing as a flow from above, is also present within us, is the truth that lies behind all the obstructive qualities that may be present. And with that feeling of light and grace flowing through you, have this thought: I offer myself just as I am, with all my strengths and weaknesses, my beauty, and the qualities that I don't feel are beautiful. I offer it all into the hands of the divine. I ask that I may have the power to accept what I cannot change, the courage to change what I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I am willing to allow this process to occur, this process of inner transformation, which is the heart of yoga, to happen naturally. I'm willing to experience whatever I have to experience, to learn what I have to learn, to let go of what I have to let go of, in order to change these obstructive patterns. I'm willing to accept the exquisite beauty that is the heart of my heart and my connection with the highest that is always present. So allow the light to shower through your body from above. With the exhalation, have the feeling whatever is not needed, whatever is not in service of my beauty, of grace, of my awakening, I offer it, asking that it be transformed, and allowing the light to shower through you, exhaling both the light and any inner and outer toxins to be released into the earth. Bring your awareness into the heart. And create in your heart the sense of the lotus that holds the light of your divinely human self. And we're going to sit for a few moments in meditation, inhaling with hum, exhaling with sa, allowing the breath to bring the power within this mantra into the heart as an offering, allowing hum to kindle the presence of the flame in the heart, allowing sa to open the heart lotus so that that light begins to fill your body. And just let yourself be in the lotus of the heart with the divine mantra that connects your self to the great self. Every inhalation offers the syllable hum to the heart. Every exhalation spreads the recognition of your heart's connection to the divine through your body. in these last moments, feel as though you look into your own heart, into the lotus in the heart, and recognize that inside your heart there is a nectarian light. Just allow yourself to recognize that this light is present, that it's always present, that whether you're aware of it or not, that nectar is bubbling up inside you. And that in those moments when you turn inside, when you're willing to make the recognition of your own nectarian beauty the highest priority, then what flows from that is love, is service, is transformation, is contentment, is purity of heart. Is gratitude, is forgiveness, is compassion, because all of these are the natural qualities of the self. And all we're doing is removing the residues. So next week, we're going to have a practice week in which we'll do some practices of asana, pranayama, and pratyahara, which are intrinsic to the yogic tradition. I'm so grateful for the opportunity to practice with you. Have a wonderful rest of your day and evening. Namaste. So much love to all of you.
मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचेतानि नाहि न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमेन तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातून वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोहं शिवोहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेन मे चिदानं शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं 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 शिवोऽहं